The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 20. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Finn McCool, Kitty Olson, Dominic Eagle, and Nikki Exposito. Tonight, we'll hear stories of perilous pickups, terrible trails, morose monstrosities, and scarring storefronts. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. You know the story about that thing, right? Sure, everybody does. It's that thing that shows up when you say its name. Or wait, no. I mean the story about that one thing that happened in your neighborhood. Wherever that neighborhood happens to be. Yes, urban legends are just another part of the landscape of horror. And tonight, we're going to be digging into the world of the stories that just happen to be true. They have to be. Because didn't Jody down the street say it happened to her? Finn McCool once again graces us with the story of a late-night binge at the bar and of a phantom cab driver who may or may not portend doom to those who ride with him. Thankfully, just such a driver doesn't really exist, right? Without further ado, I present to you the Killer Cabbie. I never used to be one for urban legends and the like. I'm a cynic at heart and not prone to flights of fancy. But, as you might have already guessed, something significant happened that changed my perspective. The phrase life-changing event might sound like a cliché, but that's what happened to me on that fateful night a couple of years ago. I was going through a rough patch at the time, my life having spiraled out of control. After I lost my job, broke up with my longtime partner, and drinking heavily to dull my pain. On the night in question, I was partying at a nightclub in my local town center. I started on the beers and moved on to shots, and I might have consumed some illegal substances to boot. Much of the night went by in a bluesy blur. I tried to chat up a couple of women with little success, and took solace in downing yet more alcohol. At one point in the evening, I found myself sitting in a quiet corner and speaking with an acquaintance of mine. Let's call him Jack. This guy was a regular at the club and liked his drink as much as I did, and he was the sort of bloke who I could hardly stand when I was sober, but could just about tolerate when drunk. And when he was buying the drinks, Jack was my best mate in the whole world. We talked and drank for some length of time. How long exactly, I can't recall. And when I say we talked, really it was Jack who spoke while I listened. Jack was, and presumably still is, a big fan of conspiracy theories. I mean, he's one of those guys who's in them in a big way. He would yap on for hours about the secret cabals who ruled the world, how vaccines were used for mind control, the moon landings were faked, lizard people walked among us, and so on. Like I said, I'm a cynic, or at least I was at the time, so I had little interest in his outlandish theories. Instead, I merely nodded, feigned interest, and occasionally came out with a, "Oh, really?" or a sarcastic comment as he continued to get the drinks in. At some point in the one-sided conversation, Jack moved on to the topic of urban legends, another area I had very little time for. I tuned out for much of his rant, but did start paying attention when Jack started talking about the legend of the killer cabbie. "What the hell is that?" I asked incredulously. Jack smiled before answering, knowing that he'd hooked me in. "The killer cabbie's a local legend. He operates right here in our hometown." I laughed before responding in a mocking tone. "What? Something interesting happened in this dump?" I exclaimed. "Oh, you'd be surprised what goes down on these streets after dark," Jack answered cryptically. I rolled my eyes dismissively. "So, this taxi driver's a serial killer or something. Funny, I didn't hear anything about a murder spree on the news." This time it was Jack's turn to laugh. "You believe what the media's telling you? Wake up, man. Besides, this guy's smart. There are no bodies and no proof that a murder has taken place. But isn't it strange how many missing person cases there are in this area?" "Yeah, sure, buddy. We've got a secret killer on the loose, but it's all being covered up. That makes perfect sense." I shook my head whilst taking another sip. I was sure Jack was talking crap, but he wouldn't let up. "This guy's much more than your average killer," he said, in almost a whisper. "For one thing, well, not everyone he takes ends up dead or missing. Some make it home, but they're not the same." "What do you mean, not the same?" I exclaimed in disbelief. Jack shushed me, looking over his shoulder before continuing. "I mean, like they've been through something that's changed them forever. They've seen things we're not meant to see. Things that'll haunt them to the grave." I'll confess that Jack's words brought a chill up my spine, but I soon dismissed my first instincts, dismissing the story as the hogwash it surely was. "Well, I gotta hand it to you, Jack. You've really outdone yourself this time. As tall tales go, that's a whopper." Jack seemed annoyed at first, but soon recovered, slapping me on the back as he said, "Mock me all you want, old mate, but you'll come to see things my way in the end. Another drink?" And the night dragged on. I lost track of Jack, had drunken conversations with some other folk, and before I knew it, the lights were switched on and the bouncers started rounding up punters and herding them out towards the doors. Closing time. I cursed, realizing that I'd let time get away from me. Before long, I was pushed out onto the pavement along with the rest of the rabble, bearing witness to the chaos which always took place in the streets at this ungodly hour, as all the pubs and clubs shut at the same time and all the drunken revelers piled out onto the streets. I witnessed the typical Saturday night scenes, a group of rowdy lads piling into the kebab shop, a scantily clad girl puking in the gutter while a friend held her hair back, and two middle-aged men fighting over a taxi. I groaned, realizing that I'd stayed out too late and hadn't pre-booked a taxi home. I took out my phone and tried my ride-sharing app, but there were no cars available. Next, I tried calling a couple of the local cab firms, but they didn't even answer the phone. Then I shook my head and realized I was screwed. I had two options at this point. Either I wait here in the cold with all these drunken lunatics, or I walk home, which would mean trekking 10 miles through some pretty dodgy neighborhoods. Neither option was in any way appealing, but I didn't see that I had another choice. And then, suddenly, I was thrown an unexpected lifeline. Across the street was a solitary taxi, an old-school black cab parked adjacent to the pavement with its lights on. I saw the dark silhouette of the driver sitting in the front, but there were no passengers in the back. It seemed too good to be true, and I was sure the driver was waiting on a fare. But none of the drunken revelers approached the vehicle, and it almost seemed like the cab was invisible to them. So I decided to chance my arm, crossing the road and approaching the driver's side before tapping on the glass. The driver lowered his window ever so slightly, not so much that I could see his face, but enough so we could talk. I guess I should have found this suspicious, but I was 5 sheets to the wind and not thinking straight. I did feel some apprehension, however, perhaps thinking back to Jack's story and wondering whether there was maybe some truth to it. It was the driver who prompted the conversation, speaking in a deep and raspy voice.
"Yes, sir. Can I help you?"
He seemed a little too polite for a late-night cabbie, which threw me off for a moment, but I eventually found the words to reply. Yeah, mate. Can you take me to Hilltown, top of Croft Road?"
"Sure. No problem, sir," the driver replied quickly.
Well, this struck me as odd, and I suspected he might be planning to rip me off. "How much?" I inquired.
"How much you got?" was the answer.
I clicked my tongue before replying. "$10.
"Sure, that's more than enough. Hop in, my friend."
The offer seemed too good to be true, so I suspected there was a catch. I put my hand on the coral door handle and froze as a sixth sense told me something wasn't right. I didn't really believe this driver was a killer, but I did think he might be trying to rob or scam me. My instincts told me to refuse the ride and walk away. But then I glanced back across the road and saw the chaos had escalated, as the fight between the two men had drawn in others, with punches being thrown and bottles getting smashed. I didn't want to stay here a moment longer, so I made my decision in opening the cab door and jumping inside. I'll confess that the alarm bells didn't start ringing straight away. I took my seat and slammed the door shut behind me. In fact, I was relieved as we drove off, leaving the mayhem of the street behind us. Feeling satisfied, I sat back and enjoyed the ride. But even through my drunken haze, I could tell this was not a normal taxicab. First, there were no seatbelts in the back, and secondly, the reinforced glass between me and the driver didn't display the taxi man's name, license number, and photograph, as should have been the case. As for the driver himself, he was focused on the road, and I could only see the back of his head. Also, I noted how there was no meter on the dashboard. These details concerned me, but not overly so. I guessed that the driver was unlicensed, but that was okay with me as long as he got me home safely. But I did get worried whenever he missed the turning to Hilltown. "Hey, mate, you're going the wrong way," I exclaimed. "No, I'm not," the driver replied with confidence. I was now sure this guy was taking me for a ride, driving the long route, so he could charge me a higher fare. He must have thought I was too drunk to notice, but I was having none of it. "Listen, pal, you need to turn this cab around," I said.
"We don't turn around, we only go forward," was the driver's puzzling reply.
I was taken aback by his words, and I started to panic, not knowing what to do next. Staring out the window, I saw inexplicable sights, which only increased my anxiety. At first, I witnessed familiar scenes, streetlights, late-night businesses, and the occasional other car on the road, but soon these signs of the modern world disappeared, and I bore witness to empty roads and crumbling buildings which I did not recognize. There were no other vehicles in sight, and no lights other than the cab's headlights and the dim illumination from the moon and stars above. I was awestruck by this bizarre development and wondered whether I'd accidentally consumed an hallucinogenic drug during my drinking session. I prayed for a return to normality, but things only got weirder from that point onwards. Soon, we left the town altogether and drove down a lonely, narrow road
leading through a dense forest. The trees on either side of the road were shrouded in darkness and appeared sinister and foreboding to my weary eyes. I stared into the black, becoming transfixed by the sight, as my exhausted brain attempted to make some sense of the craziness. But the longer I looked into the darkness, the more I was mesmerized. I felt like I was staring into an abyss at the edge of the universe, and so I was both terrified and fascinated in equal measure. As my eyes adjusted to the dark, I swore I could see movement just beyond the tree line, shadowy shapes darting between the tree trunks and fleeing whenever they saw the car's headlights. I looked closer, focusing on a solitary shadow who glared out at me through the darkness, flashing a pair of eyes that were a deadly shade of demonic red. "My God," I swore, jumping up from my seat in terror. "Where the hell are you taking me?" I shouted.
"Taking you home,"
the driver calmly replied, "assuming that's where you want to go." I shook my head in dismay, having lost all patience with this dodgy cabbie. I shifted over in my seat, trying to open the right side door and then the one on the left. Both were locked. I cursed as I pulled my phone from my pocket, my hand shaking as I entered my security code. But guess what? There was no signal. At this point, I lost my head. I banged my fists and kicked my boots against the reinforced perspex glass that separated me from the driver, screaming, "Let me out of here, you bastard!" The driver's response was instant and terrifying. He turned his head, and allowing me to see his face for the first time, and it was horrifying. His eyes were not those of a human being, but instead they were jet black, like you'd see on a shark. He glared at me with pure fury in those godforsaken eyes before opening his mouth to reveal a gaping hole, and the voice that came out of his mouth, well, it was deep and demonic.
"Shut the hell up and sit down," he screamed.
I recoiled in horror, shrinking back into my seat, not moving an inch. I couldn't bear to look into his demonic eyes, but thankfully, the driver soon turned around and focused on the road ahead. I sat back for some time, frozen in shock, as I tried to come to terms with my terrifying predicament. Eventually, I plucked up the courage to speak through quaking lips.
"You're going to kill me, aren't you?"
I asked, thinking back to Jack's tale and realizing it must be true.
"You'll kill me and make me disappeared just like all the others."
The driver surprised me by laughing aloud.
"No, sir, I'm not going to kill you," he answered. "I've never killed anybody, and no one disappears unless they want to."
I took a deep breath, frustrated by receiving yet another nonsensical answer, and I still feared for my life, as I believed the creepy driver was more than capable of ripping me to shreds. But I think the cabbie must have read my thoughts based on his next question.
"You don't believe me, do you?"
he asked. The words almost stuck in my mouth, but I answered nonetheless. "No, no, I don't." The driver laughed again.
"Well, I can't say as I blame you, sir. I guess you need some more proof. Let's make a quick stop."
Within a few moments, he'd pulled into a lay-by by the side of the road before he shut off the cab's engine and headlights. I scanned around nervously, seeing nothing but the darkened forest on all sides of the vehicle, and suddenly I reached a new level of raw panic.
"What the hell are you doing?"
I exclaimed fearfully.
"Just wait,"
was the driver's only response. My eyes widened and my heartbeat quickened as I saw the dark shapes emerging from behind the trees, moving slowly at first but quickly gaining momentum as they crashed through the undergrowth. Turning my head, I saw others approaching from the other side of the road and realized we would soon be surrounded. The first slammed his white palms in the glass, making me jump and yelp in fright. I looked up to see a zombie-like figure with dead eyes and a filthy maw filled with rotten teeth. He screamed like a maniac as he continued to violently bang against the car's window, desperately trying to get at me. And suddenly there were others, A half dozen zombies, at least, all dressed in ragged clothes and screaming blue murder as they assaulted the vehicle from all sides. I was overcome with terror, whimpering like a coward and rolling myself up into a protective ball as I prepared for the end. But suddenly, the taxi's engine burst back to life, and its headlights illuminated the scene. The zombies didn't react to the light moving away from the vehicle as they shielded their black eyes. And then the driver slammed his fist in the horn, emitting a loud and piercing sound that overwhelmed the zombies' senses and forced them to retreat back into the forest. Thus satisfied, the cabbie drove off and rejoined the lonely road. It took some moments for me to calm myself back down and recover from the shock. Once again, I was able to breathe, and I asked one question through trembling lips. "What are those things?" I demanded. "Those things were once people like you," the cabbie confirmed. "They're the ones who didn't make it." I felt a sickness rising from the pit of my stomach as I faced this new existential threat. Was I going to become one of those damned creatures? Was this to be my fate? "Am I dead?" I eventually whispered, dreading the sound I would receive, but realizing that I must find out the truth. "No," the driver answered coolly. "Well, not yet, at least. But you have an important decision still to make, one which will determine your destiny." I didn't like the sound of that, not one bit. But I was a prisoner in the taxi cab and certainly didn't fancy any chances in the forest, even if I could make it out. To my horror, I realized I was completely at the driver's mercy. We drove on for some time in complete silence, my eyes drifting to the sides of the road, where I could see the dark shapes continuing to move between the trees, as if they were tracking our progress and waiting for another opportunity to strike. Eventually, we reached what appeared to be the end of the road, the vehicle stopping at a fork that offered two choices. To the left was a road that led up a hill that towered over the forest, and at its summit was a cross that shone brightly, its white light illuminating the dark night. I can't say what it was about the light, but it was calling to me, appearing like a safe port in a fierce storm. In that moment, I wanted more than anything to get to it. And the second road drifted off to the right, leading through yet more forest to an unknown destination. The enigmatic driver didn't turn left or right. Instead, he simply stopped the car and waited. "What happens next?" I asked nervously.
"That's up to you," he replied. "This is your decision."
I remained silent for a moment, staring up at the light as my heart ached and my eyes filled with tears.
"What's up there?"
I asked through trembling lips.
"Something extraordinary. Beyond your wildest dreams," was his cryptic answer. "Can you take me there?"
"No," he responded firmly. "I cannot ascend the hill. If you want to proceed in that direction, you'll have to do so on your own two feet."
"What?"
I cried incredulously.
"You want me to get out of the car? With those monsters still out there?"
"I don't want you to do anything," the driver answered. "It's entirely up to you, sir. There are risks in taking that route. If you fail, you'll be trapped in this place like the others. On the other hand, if you succeed, the rewards could be great." Reluctantly, I turned my head away from the white light and toward the dark road to our right.
"And what about that way?" I inquired. "Yes, I can take you down there," the driver confirmed.
"And what's at the end of the second road?" The cabbie paused for a moment as if deep in thought. But when he did finish replying, his answer was typically vague.
"That road leads somewhere, not perfect, but familiar."
I shook my head, my mind racing as I tried to make this impossible decision. As I racked my brains to consider my two options, I missed, almost, the two dark figures emerging from the forest, creeping ever closer to our stationary taxi. I need a decision, sir, the driver prompted. It's not safe to remain here indefinitely. The tension was unbearable. I sensed that this was the most important decision I would ever make, and in the end, I went with my head over my heart. I'm not ready, I whimpered. I can't go to the light, not yet. I swore I could hear satisfaction in the driver's voice as he replied. Very good, sir, he said. A moment later, he started to drive, avoiding the grasping, claw-like hands of the zombies, as he sped down the road to the right. I instantly turned around in my seat, looking out the back window over the heads of the undead, and casting my eyes upon the cross of the white light, watching with tears in my eyes until the light faded. And when I turned back around, I was astonished to discover that we were no longer driving through the haunted woods. Instead, the cab was on a city street, and not just any street. It was my home street. Seconds later, the driver pulled outside of my house, and I heard a sudden click as the doors were unlocked. There you go, sir, the driver said cheerfully. I told you I'd get you home, in the end. Oh, and don't worry about the fare. This one's on the house. I was still in a state of shock, but relieved to be within touching distance of home and safety. And so I opened the door and stepped out onto the pavement, struggling to walk on my shaking feet. I stood there for a moment, trying to adjust my abrupt return to reality. I still had so many unanswered questions, but when I turned back toward the taxi, I saw that the cabbie had already driven off. I watched as the taxi proceeded down my street before it inexplicably vanished at the bottom of the road, seemingly disappearing into thin air as I rubbed my eyes in astonishment. My friend Jack had been right about some details, wrong about others. The killer cabbie legend was real, but the otherworldly driver wasn't the killer. He was my savior. I don't think it's a coincidence that I ended up in his cab that night. I believe I was chosen. Whatever the case, my life did change after that fateful night. I sobered up and got my act together. I can't say that my life has been all roses since my paranormal experience, but things are certainly better. Still, I often wonder what would have happened if I'd chosen the other path. Could I have made it to the light, and if so, what would I have witnessed and experienced on the other side? I'm afraid these are questions for smarter men than me, and I'll leave you, the readers and listeners, to reach your own conclusions. So, take my story for what you will, my friends. Stay safe out there. I hope you enjoyed The Killer Cabbie by Finn McCool, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Finn-McCool. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/FINN-MCCOOL. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. On the plus side, I feel a little bit better knowing that cabbie isn't quite the monster he's described as. On the other, I feel less comfortable about having to jog to a far-off sanctuary in a forest full of monsters. But, hey, once one speedrunner does it, suddenly everyone's doing it. A lot of the time, legends grow not because of the area itself, but because of the stories kids tell to each other. In this tale from Kitty Olson, we'll hear of one fellow's long-time encounter with one such tale from his friends in school and a long, scary trip through the forest. But just how much of the tale is true? Without further ado, I present to you The Ghost Trail. As an army brat, I had two options. Get dragged from place to place over the years, switch schools, and have to start from scratch when it came to making friends, or I could go off to the boarding school my dad went to as a kid. I ended up picking the latter choice. I was 15 years old and moving all the time was stressful. I just wanted to be a normal teen, you know? And I was going to be at Chapman Academy for Young Men, all boys school. We wore uniforms, had a strict set of rules to follow, and to be honest, I thrived in that environment. It was stable. I learned independence. I had to be accountable for myself, do my homework, and eat balanced meals. It probably didn't work for every boy in that school, but it did wonders for me. And I made friends, too. I ran with a small pack of other boys, Frank, Jesse, and Philip. Frank was the leader for us, always wanting to push the limits of authority, always wanting to stick it to the man. I didn't really join in on the rule-breaking, but I did watch some of his more outrageous stunts. He got into a lot of trouble more than once, but he somehow always managed to sweet-talk himself out of getting expelled. I liked Frank. I didn't always approve of what he got up to, but he was a good friend. It was his idea, naturally, to try the ghost trail trick. He first brought it up after we got back from winter break. We were all chilling in Jesse's room. He was plucking at his guitar. Philip was talking about his girlfriend at home that I was fairly certain didn't actually exist. And then Frank turned to me with the biggest grin on his face. "So Dale, since you're new this year, I bet you don't know the story of the ghost trail." That got the room's attention. Jesse and Philip notably perked up while I shook my head. "I bet you're going to tell me all about it, though," I said. Frank laughed before he hunched over, like some deformed ghoul, and spoke in what I presumed he thought was a terrifying voice. "It's the trail that leads to the nearby girls' school. Oh, during the day, there's nothing to fear. It's at night when things get spooky." Frank waggled his fingers and made some ghost sounds. "Legend has it that the trail's filled with spirits. Dark, evil spirits. They can be summoned in only one way. There's a matching set of oak trees at each end of the trail. You approach one with a flashlight, aim the beam at the tree, and then turn it on and off 5 times. Legend has it the hair on your neck will stand up. You'll feel a cold breeze, and then you'll have to walk the whole length of the trail, because if you turn around, a ghost will claw your eyeballs out." Frank lunged at me, which startled me enough to nearly fall off the bed. I called him a jerk after that. We all laughed, and then we dropped the topic to talk about the hot girls that went to the academy on the other side of the trail. Well, we figured they were hot. None of us really got dates with them. We were all too awkward to really get any attention like that. We didn't talk about the ghost trail again until spring break. It was optional to return home during that particular break, and I wanted to spend time with my friends. So after some begging and pleading with my parents, they agreed to let me stay at the school during spring break. I think they were a bit grateful for it, honestly. They had their plates full with my little siblings. They'd miss me, but it'd be easier on them if I stayed at school. I wish I'd gone home. It was a lot of fun just chilling at the dorms. Philip's mom sent him what felt like a truckload of snacks and goodies. We played card games, we ran around the mostly empty campus like a pack of hooligans, and we were having a blast. Spring break was drawing to a close when Frank announced what we'd be doing that night. The ghost trail. We'd be bringing the myth to life. I was hesitant at first. Sure, I didn't really believe in ghosts, but it would involve going off campus. Even on break, we needed permission to do that. But Frank was so excited about the idea, and he insisted that we'd have a good time. He even found someone to buy us some beers so we could drink and be merry. Jesse and Philip were just as hyped for this, so I caved. Besides, I wanted to drink and have fun with my friends, too. We got to the ghost trail of urban legend around 8 p.m. It was a bit chilly, but I had a coat on. I wasn't going to chicken out, thanks to a few shivers. Frank agreed to go first. The oak tree was just around the bend. and we agreed to space out our adventures about 5 minutes at a time. It'd be scarier if we went at it alone. We'd also do it without our flashlights on, once we did the trick to summon the ghosts. Once we all met at the other side of the trail, we'd walk back together, probably laughing and trying to scare each other again. We watched as Frank disappeared around the corner. Through the tree line, we saw the flashes of his light and nothing. 5 minutes went by, then Jesse and Philip argued about who'd go next. It ended up being Jesse, whose nervous laugh was not unlike a hyena's as he scuttled to the tree. 5 flashes. Darkness. Philip and I were really feeling the quiet now. Frank was the loud one out of the group, and with just the two of us, it was mostly just weak jokes followed by long periods of silence. Finally, it was Philip's turn, and I think he was just glad to get going. He hightailed it to the tree, leaving me alone in the dark. I almost chickened out now that I was alone. No other boys to be brave in front of, but I stayed strong. 5 minutes ticked away in my watch, but it felt like 5 hours instead. Once I assumed Philip had gotten far enough ahead, I headed to the tree. I'd never seen it before, but it was hard to miss. A large oak tree, older than perhaps most of the trees here. I steadied my nerves, raised my flashlight, and clicked it on and off 5 times. The darkness seemed all the thicker when the light turned off the last time. I swallowed the lump in my throat and felt sweat start to bead on my forehead. My heart thumped so loud in my chest that I felt the whole world could hear it. Then, just like in the story, the hair on my neck stood up and I knew I wasn't alone. Fear kicked my instincts into overdrive. I spun around, flashlight on, ready to fight for my life. Only to see a girl throw up her hands and squeal in terror. I stared at her as I tried to convince my heart to slow down. She lowered her hands and stared back. She wasn't what I would have called pretty. Mousy brown hair tied in a braid, her school uniform a size too big, clunky glasses, braces, a patch of acne on her chin. But not nearly as scary as the supposed ghosts that walked the trail and tore out teenagers' eyeballs. We kept on staring for a few moments, and then we both burst into laughter. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. I apologized. No, it's okay. I shouldn't have sneaked up on you like that. She twirled her braid around her fingers with a sheepish grin. So you're starting the ghost trail, yeah? I just finished. Oh, really? Spy any ghosts? I asked. The girl shook her head, that awkward smile still on her face. Don't think I did. I think I spotted some other boys, too. Did they ditch you? Nah, we decided to go at it one at a time. Finally, starting to calm down, I flicked my flashlight back to the trail. You want me to walk you back to the girls' school? The girl lit up. I don't think she had many guys asking her to do anything, much less go on a night walk. I'd like that. It'd be less scarier that way. I'm Robin. No, I'm Dale. Good to meet you, Robin. My heart was beating fast again, but it was for a whole other reason. Robin fell in pace with me, and awkward looking or not, she was still a girl. And taking a walk with a girl, any girl, made me feel all sorts of butterflies. So, you like school, Robin? That was the only conversation opener I could think of, and I immediately hated myself for ever opening my stupid mouth. And thankfully, Robin didn't find the question awkward. I mean, the actual classes? Yeah, I like those. And I like being in band. I don't really have many friends, though. I'm not very good with people. Is that why you immediately assumed my friends ditched me? Again, the awkward questions. But I pressed on. Your friends ditch you? Robin huffed, a few loose strands of hair falling into her face. Yep. She popped her lips quite loudly on the P. It's not the first time. It's fine. At least I'm not a wimp. I made it to the end of the trail, after all. Now I just gotta make my way back. I hope I can. You will, I reassured her. I mean, I gotta make it to your end, so we might as well make it together, right? Robin bobbed her head up and down, but her smile was less awkward now. Yeah, we can make it. I'm sorry, I'm probably boring you. I'm not asking you anything about yourself. What grade are you in? Do you like your friends? The conversation went on from there. Just fun small talk, really. I learned Robin played the clarinet and had some serious pollen allergies, which is why she agreed to walk the trail so early in the year, so she could avoid the worst of the pollen. She had a cat back home named Snowball. She also had a dad in the military, but she was an only child, and her mom died when she was young, so she'd been shipped off to boarding school ever since her elementary days. That sounded lonely, and I told her so. She just shrugged. Yeah, it is what it is. I don't mind. A few times, I almost had the guts to reach for her hand. I was a dumb kid. I'd never even kissed a girl before, so the whole holding hands thing felt as frightening as a marriage proposal. I didn't end up going through with it, though. My hands were so sweaty they probably would have slipped right through her fingers. At the very least, it would have grossed her out. Teenage fantasies, though. In the 10 minutes we spent walking down that trail, I felt like we had a lot in common. So clearly, we were meant to be. We both liked to read, we both liked the same bands, we both understood what it was like to feel overlooked, me by my family, her by her friends. Her friends were a real sticking point for her. When Robin said their names, she almost spat them out with how angry she sounded. Marie, Carrie, Amy, Danielle. Robin kicked a stick and sent it flying off the path with the force. They only became my friend after we got stuck on a group project together. I ended up doing most of the work, they took most of the credit. And ever since, unless I want to eat alone, I let them do what they want. They don't sound like real friends, I said. I don't think so either, Robin admitted, kicking another stick before she seemed to sag under the emotional weight of being a lonely high school kid. But it's either them or no one, and really, what would you pick? Something kind of sucks, or nothing that sucks even more. I didn't have an answer for that, so I shrugged. She nodded. It's not the best, but when I graduate, maybe I can go to college, find some real friends there. Now, what you gonna study? Don't know. Maybe I'll be a vet. I still got a lot of time to decide, though. We turned the corner in the path, and I cheered as I spotted the girls' school through the tree line. It wasn't super close, but I knew that meant we were reaching the end of the trail, which meant this challenge was almost over and I could go back with the boys. We're almost done. See, you proved your friends wrong, Robin. Do you believe in ghosts, Dale? Robin had come to a stop behind me, not budging on the path. I turned and frowned. I mean, I did the challenge and nothing happened, so I guess I don't. Robin bowed her head before she gently pushed past me. Walk carefully, she murmured under her breath. It felt like ice was forming crystals in my skin, but I followed her. It was a good thing she warned me. Even with my flashlight, I just about missed the path, which made a sudden turn to the right and going straight led right into a steep ravine. This is as far as I can go. This is as far as I got, after all. Robin stared into the ravine, keeping her face pointed away from me. I swallowed. What are you talking about, Robin? A soft sob caught in her throat before she steadied herself. When my friends ditched me on this path, they didn't leave me with a flashlight. I had to walk back completely in the dark. I was so relieved when I saw the school, I started running. I didn't see the curve until it was too late. Your friends didn't either. My breath caught. No, she wasn't serious. This was just a joke, and I was waiting for the punchline. But she didn't move, so I looked down in the ravine. The beam of my flashlight landed on 3 all-too-still bodies. Even with blood soaking their clothes, I could recognize their school uniform. Philip, Jesse, Frank. All 3 of them were at the bottom of the ravine, all of them too still. 2 of them face down except for Frank. Frank's face was twisted in terror. The hollows where eyes were supposed to be, just gaping holes. Red dripping down his cheeks like tears.
It looked like something out of a nightmare. It couldn't be my friends, could it?
I'm glad you turned around.
I didn't want to turn around now. The air was colder now. I could feel the wind biting into me like icy fangs. But I did. Robin was different now, or maybe she'd been different the whole time and I just wasn't able to see. She was bone thin, her features sunken, her skin drained of any color. Her glasses were smashed, but did little to hide the fact. Her eyes were glazed over, turning them almost milky white. Blood clotted on her forehead, sticky and dark. I didn't die in the fall, I just hit my head. Broke my legs. No one came looking for me. My father didn't ask why I stopped sending letters. My so-called friends were too scared to admit that they were the reason I'd been out here. It took me days to die. Robin tilted her head to the side, her tangled braid flopping back over her shoulder. They did come back, weeks later, but they didn't leave. I would have been happy to move on after I killed them, but I just made things worse for myself because now they're stuck here too. Robin sniveled and wiped away rusty tears from her cheeks. You know, Dale, you're the first person to ever look back at me. You're really nice. I wish we could have met when I was alive. She took a step closer to me, and I froze up as she reached up to touch my cheek. Her fingertips were ice cold and ragged like she'd tried to claw her way up the ravine and just succeeded in ripping open her hands. She had to step on tiptoe, but she managed to brush her freezing lips against mine. You would have been a great boyfriend. Run. Don't look back until we get to the other end of the trail. The others, they're not going to be so kind if they get their hands on you. Run. I didn't need to be told twice. I bolted like a scared deer, nearly dropping my flashlight. I wanted to turn back to tell Robin. What? Thanks for not killing me? Ask her why she was sparing me? But I didn't. I listened to her instructions and I ran. The wind howled in my ears, sounding like the angered screeches of a thousand demons, or perhaps a troop of girls whose awful prank on the lonely Robin would be their last. The other oak tree wasn't much further, but I was still sweating buckets by the time I skidded to a stop next to it. I was shaking so badly that I thought I was going to pass out. Now, on the other side, I allowed myself to look back. I was alone. Perfectly, entirely alone. The only thing I could hear now was a bird calling in the distance. I waited until morning until I made the trek back to school. I was not going back onto that path in the dark. Unlike Robin's so-called friends, though, I didn't wait to tell a staff member that something had happened. I didn't tell the whole truth. I didn't want to be shipped off to the crazy house. I just said we went out to the ghost trail, and I reached the end, but they never showed up. It didn't take them long to find the bodies. Cops had questions, but in the end, the case would just go cold. It was too strange to be natural causes. But there was no way I was able to get the drop on the three other boys, cut their throats and gouge out their eyes, all with not a mark on me or any blood in my clothes. I had just been a lucky survivor. I ended up looking up Robin. Sure enough, she'd gone missing just a few years before, but they'd only found her when they went to look for the other girls. By then, she was little more than bones. She'd been buried in a local cemetery. I went there once before I went home. It was pretty overgrown, but I cleaned it up. Left some wildflowers on the headstone. Told her thank you for saving my life. Told her I was sorry about what had happened to her. I was met with silence. But on the way back, I happened to pass the trailhead for the supposed ghost trail. It was just a second. A flash out of the corner of my eye. But I swore I saw a girl in uniform smiling at me. Perhaps she was thanking me, too, just for being her friend.
I hope you enjoyed The Ghost Trail by Kitty Olson, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kitty-Olson. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/KITTY-OLSEN. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. A brilliant man once said, "Watch out for that first step. It's a doozy." Guess he was right, eh? Sometimes people know about a legend, but nobody ever believes they're telling the truth, even when that encounter changes their lives forever. Take, for instance, this tale from Dominic Eagle, of a figure who doesn't care to be looked at in a certain way, and of a few people who he's taken for a long-term interest in. Without further ado, I present to you, We Keep Our Kindness. We keep our kindness. Every morning my mother would repeat that bleak mantra, and I would sigh whilst absent-mindedly nodding my head in agreement. We were the opposing poles of a magnet. We gelled, but our beliefs sat at differing ends of the scale. Not political beliefs, beliefs about the very fundamental nature of humanity. I was soft, like Dad, and Mum knew that. After what happened, I think I found a happy medium. Dad died when I was a little boy. He was a good man, and I don't mean that in the obligatory cliched way. He was truly a good man. Too good, in my mum's words. He unintentionally killed himself with kindness. On a late-night commute home, a man attempted to rob my father. Dad, being Dad, tried to help the man, who was only 19. Little more than a child. My father reached for his phone, offering to search for a place where the boy could stay the night. The teenager, however, panicked when he saw Dad move. In an instant, he stabbed my father. None of the passengers did anything until the boy fled the train. Someone called 999. They tried to stop the bleeding. They kept Dad warm. But my father passed away on the cold, unforgiving bench of Platform 1. Neither Mum nor I had been by his side during those final moments. He passed before paramedics even arrived. In contrast, my mother is difficult. She's not a cruel woman. She loves me, but she's nothing like Dad. She's tough, cynical, and reserved. Once, I even garnered a scathing look for donating to a friendly man on the street. How many times, Nathan? We keep our kindness. That's how we survive, she said. It's a charity, Mum, I sighed, dropping a penny into the smiling man's bucket. Relax. I am relaxed, she huffed. Let's go home. I'm not a child. I'm 25, and I have a steady income. I know I should have moved out, but it isn't safe to leave my mother on her own. Dad's been dead for 6 years, and she only worsens with every passing anniversary. Her sturdy demeanor was once her strength, but it's become her weakness. To the rest of the world, she's nothing more than an unkind woman. I'm the only one who really knows her, the real her. The only one who knows why she became this way. And it wasn't just Dad's death. We need to shut the curtains, Mum winced, hurrying to the window. How many times do I have to tell you, Nathan? I sighed, patting the cushion beside me. I'll try to remember. Come on, Mum, let's watch some TV. Kitchen Nightmares? You hate that show, she sighed, sitting on the very edge of the sofa cushion. I know, but you like it, I said. I'll just catch up on some work. I should probably make us some dinner, Mum muttered. Mum, we've been through this. I'm going to cook dinner. Okay? I insisted. You've got to let me do something, she scoffed. I shook my head. I'm 25 and living at home with my mother. I'm cooking the meals. That's final. Well, what are we having then, chef? She asked, offering a rare smile. I'm thinking bangers and mash might be... Oh, shoot. I forgot to get the potatoes. I'll have to nip to the shop, I said, jumping off the sofa. Mom tutted, It's 9 o'clock in the evening, Nathan. That's too late. It's fine, Mom. They'll be open for another hour or so, I said. My mother groaned and shifted uncertainly, and she was nearing the edge of the cushion on which she precariously perched. No, I don't like you walking around in the dark, she mumbled. I placed a kiss in her forehead, ruffled her hair, and chuckled as she straightened her locks. I'm an adult, and I'll be fine, I said. I'll see you in 10 minutes. Mom shouted something after me, and though I had already slammed the door, I knew exactly what she said. The same thing she said whenever I left the house. The same thing she's been saying for 6 years. Don't smile at strangers, Nathan. And on this particular evening, I was going to learn that Mum's words of caution had both nothing and everything to do with the death of my father. The real reason I insisted on cooking was that Mum wasn't well. She hardly left the house. She was a mortgage advisor, and she'd been working entirely from home since 2020. Things are slightly better now, but I had to drag her out of the house whilst she wriggled and whined. And wherever we went, she watched people with eerie eagle eyes. Her head would snap toward the slightest movement, and she treated strangers like criminals. This behavior didn't start immediately after Dad's death. It started 4 years ago, during the early days of the pandemic. One evening, my mother returned home in tears and she could barely speak. She'd been delivering Grandma's shopping to her doorstep, and she bumped into a rather sullen-looking man. He wasn't wearing a face mask, which made my mum a little uncomfortable, but she didn't want to antagonize him. So she did the thing that Grandma had always taught her to do when faced with a frightening man. Mum smiled at him. However, the man simply shook his head, deepening the sorrowful expression on his haunted face. My mum claimed the man grew 10 feet tall and pursued her home. At the time, it seemed to me that the trauma of the situation had caused her to exaggerate certain details. I was certain she'd been pursued by a horrible man, but I didn't believe in her supernatural tale. She buried herself in research over the coming months, and one day, she found answers. She started ranting and raving about the morose man, a gentleman who stalks those who make the unknowing mistake of smiling at him. At the stroke of midnight, he tires and lets them be. It seemed like nonsense to me, though over the following years I did notice that name in online circles. People mentioned encounters with the morose man on forums. I thought it to be nothing but an elaborate form of collaborative fan fiction, much like The Backrooms or Slender Man. My mom was the unfortunate wounded soul caught in the fray. A woman, already fractured by her husband's death, susceptible to influence. I wasn't diminishing her experience. A traumatic encounter with a terrible man had broken her completely. But he was just a man, I told myself. My skepticism would soon unravel. Sir? The shop owner repeated. Foggy-eyed had been watching the cigarettes behind the disinterested corner shop owner, yearning for them, though it was a habit I tried hard to kick. My entire life had been consumed by Mom, sheltering her, trying to heal her. It was rare for me to get a moment to myself, and I often found myself daydreaming in the shop. It was a small slice of peace. But that was my own decision. My mother had frequently tried to get me to settle down with my girlfriend. Sorry, I said, pulling up my credit card. How much is it? £14.36, the man repeated, sighing quietly. I nodded and pointed at the cigarettes. Pack of those too, please. Following the horrors that I'm about to reveal, I found healthier coping mechanisms. I stopped seeking happiness at the butt of a combustible cylinder. Watch your step, the owner warned as I exited his corner stop. It was too late. I tripped and my bag of food spilled at the feet of a man by the bus shelter. Oh, sorry, I gushed. I proceeded to scoop up my fallen items, cheeks flushed from embarrassment. The milk carton had burst, spilling its contents into a growing puddle around the man's shoes. Would you like me to clean this for you? I know a good launderette. So sorry, I said. The man didn't respond. His eyes rigidly watched me. There was something about him that didn't sit well. As if it were an outfit he wore, dripping flesh. It barely belonged to the body that it covered. His eyes looked black, but I convinced myself that they just weren't showing in the dim light. I'm really sorry, sir, I said, sheepishly, collecting my shopping and standing up. Then I did something Mum had warned me to never do. I smiled at the man. And the man did not smile back. He, in fact, shook his head, and his face adopted a look twice as sullen. The air froze in horror, and the moon cowered behind rain clouds, robbing the street of any light other than the flickering fluorescent tube above the harrowed gentleman. But as a shiver traversed the length of my body, I started to think that the man might not be unhappy at all. A scene unfolded that you might struggle to believe. The man's arms and legs lengthened, as did his shabby, ill-fitting farmer's clothes. And as he rose taller, his head tore through the metal roof of a bus shelter. I stumbled backwards, eyeing the malignant monstrosity before me. My mother hadn't imagined anything. The morose man was real, and I shouldn't have smiled at him. We keep our kindness. My fingers automatically released the shopping bag and I ran. The road home seemed to have grown longer and darker. The moonlight had vanished from our world, and my breathing quickened as, one by one, the streetlights turned off. But as I sprinted into the blackness, I realized that I couldn't hear anything behind me. I spun on my heel to face the pursuing man, but there was nobody in my wake. Only a demolished bus shelter in the distance, and a few remaining streetlights. Still, I didn't stop to search for the horrifying creature beyond our world. I continued running until I arrived home. As I neared our house, however, my relief was rapidly replaced with fear. The front door was ajar. Did I lock it? I whispered to myself, inching closer to the ominous opening. I know I did. I unsteadily entered our barren, unlit home. Mom, I cried, are you okay? She didn't respond, so I crept along the ground floor of our abandoned house. I could hear only the rhythmic beat of my heart against my chest. Everything was still in its place. We hadn't been burgled. But there was that chill in the air, that stillness I felt at the bus shelter. A sense that Mother Nature had seen something that made her fearful. Something near, there lay a terror which didn't belong. I completed a full circle of the ground floor. Then I eyed the upstairs landing from the safety of the downstairs hall. Light poured into the entryway from the street, yet it did not, somehow, seem able to reach the upper floor of the house. Something about that filled me with dread. The blackness of the second floor seemed foreboding. But I made my way up the stairs, one groaning step at a time. I clutched the banister with more might than I knew I possessed, and I hardly wanted to let go when I eventually reached the landing. I pulled my phone out and lit the way with the flashlight. Mom, I whispered, voice cracking, are you okay? Still no reply. I searched every room, but I found nothing, not a furnishing out of place, not a thing stolen other than my mother. She left the house, I reassured myself. She went somewhere. She went looking for you. That thought stilled the restlessness gripping my body, and I turned to head back downstairs. Then, as I swung my flashlight across the upstairs landing, I glimpsed a slight movement at the window. The blackened window. Unnaturally black. I couldn't visualize the faintest outline of the street beyond the glass pane.
but I could see something. Something disturbingly familiar. A rippling movement beyond the pane, and then two blackened curtains of skin parted. The megalithic eyeball filled the window. A black pupil eyed the insect in the house, and the insect yelled in terror as the enormous eye shifted to the left. The giant vanished from view, allowing the light from street lamps to pour through the window once more. When I ran into the street, he was gone. I knew he'd taken my mother. I spent half a day lying on the living room carpet in a semi-comatose state. I was unable to process the awful things I'd just witnessed. Everything I knew about reality was false. I'd been so certain about the laws of nature, so certain about everything having a place. But there was no place for the abomination I'd just seen. Even its skin sat uncertainly on its head. What horrors lay beneath? I didn't want to know. What could I do? I couldn't call the police and report a paranormal situation. The sunlight had been scorching my pale, unmoving face for hours when I finally mustered up the will to move. I sat upright and pulled my limp, shivering body to the sofa. My laptop was still sitting on the cushion. In a flustered panic, I began researching the morose man. I scoured every crevice of the internet, collected every piece of information I could find, and I reached out to the numerous people who'd reported sightings of the unholy being. One particular Discord server, entitled 11, proved useful. Members told me many secrets to surviving the entity. "I don't need to survive," I replied. "It's taken my mother." And the help ended there. People offered their condolences. Everyone except Throwaway Girl 125X9. "I saw him over a year ago, and my life has never been the same," she said. "I spend every waking hour wondering whether he might be waiting for me around every corner. I understand your mother's fear. I felt it, too. I don't trust strangers anymore, and I certainly don't take the train. I just live in my room, endlessly online, endlessly searching for answers. Though I don't know the true nature of this entity, I do know a way in which we could save your mother." "How do we know she wasn't killed by that thing?" I asked. He grew to an unimaginable size. That meant he hadn't been fed. He didn't intend to feed on her. He only eats victims who are full of joy. Those, like him, full of pain, join his collection. "You need to perform the ritual I've outlined in the attached document. It'll open a gateway to his home." "How do I trust you?" I asked. "You don't, and I don't trust you. That's why I won't come to help you. I can barely leave my house. But the internet feels safe, doesn't it? It feels removed from all this horror somehow. It can be whatever we want it to be." "I trust an online stranger, even less than a stranger on the street. Could be anyone or anything. How do I know you haven't sent a ritual that would lead to something worse?" I asked. "My name's Paige Mulligan. I'm 26 and I live in Manchester." "There, you know more than you should. Don't make me regret that. And I'm telling you that this ritual is the only way to save your mom. Either try or lose her forever. Those are your options," Paige said. Cut between a rock and a treacherous place, I decided to hold on to the thing that separated me from my mother. I still had some faith in mankind. I still trusted in the kindness of strangers, despite my haunting encounter with the morose man. I read the scripture that Paige had provided. Firstly, I shut all doors in the living room as instructed, and as I spoke the morose man's summoning sentence, I held my breath. I expected the sound of tolling bells from the earth's undercarriage. I expected the ground to shift beneath my feet. I expected hellfire and a storm like none the world had ever seen. Instead, my living room door softly clicked and it squeaked open. I trembled at the sight of blackness beyond the open doorway, realizing that my downstairs hallway no longer lay beyond the living room. And as I stepped toward the exit, my eyes adjusted to the darkness. I could distinguish a dark, damp outdoor alleyway, an alleyway that led to a garish yellow door. As I began my journey along the unearthly passage, I frequently glanced over my shoulder, desperately ensuring that my living room remained behind me. But when I reached the bright door at the end of the alleyway, I knew I had to abandon all semblance of safety. I grabbed the door handle and turned. My eyes were greeted by something vile and vibrant. A one-floor house that had seemingly been artificially generated. A cluster of mismatched colors covered the interior of the tiny bungalow. Red and blue walls, green carpet. And beyond the entryway, a never-ending row of rooms stretched to the horizon. It was a limitless liminal space. And my mother was buried somewhere in the depths of that malicious maze. I decided to walk directly ahead, as I knew I'd lose my way if I were to deviate from the path. Each room was less convincing than the last. The colors grew busier and the furnishings grew more disjointed. There was also an unsettling mixture of maroon stains and damaged paint. "Nathan!" The whisper jolted my heart, and I flew into the far wall of the kitchen, the 13th one I had explored in that demented home. When I turned, I found myself facing a frail, withered woman on an obscenely tall dining chair in the corner of the room. It had only been a day since I'd last seen her, but I hardly recognized her. "Mom," I whispered. "What are you doing here?" she asked in a sinisterly stiff voice. "I came to save you," I said. "This is my hole," she muttered, transfixed by the walls of the kitchen. "I belong here." "No, you don't," I urged, starting to tug her arms. "He knows I'll never smile again," she moaned, staring blankly at the wall. I yanked, and my mom tumbled off the chair. She snapped out of the trance, but she continued to fight me. "Leave me here," she cried. "No," I croaked. "Mom, please." "He won't haunt you again," she promised. "He has me. That's all he ever wanted." "I'm not going to let him trap you anymore," I firmly said. "Zach would have. He would have made it all better." Mom bawled whilst I dragged her through the endless line of rooms to the yellow front door. A whirring sound, like a living machinery, came from the walls of the endless bungalow. And the vibrant colors began to swirl into something far darker, far murkier. "Mom, please," I urged. "Dad's gone now. He's gone, but we're still here. We get to move forward." "It isn't safe," she cried. "You won't be safe. The shadow hangs over me." The blackness was spreading across the walls like a fungus, and I was hurrying my resistant mother out of the morose man's haunted house. "We'll find a way through this," I said, pulling Mom into the main entryway. "We'll do it together." I opened the yellow door, eyeing our escape route with a tremendous sense of victory in my heart. But then I heard a terrifying sound. I whirled my head around, and my eyes met a frightfully familiar sight. The morose man. An entity that slipped out of the blackened walls of his unmasked home. No vibrant false colors remained, only the true darkness that had been there all along. The morose man was smaller than before, but his face was worse. It was not even feigning humanity. He watched us with undeniably black eyes, and his mouth hung slackly, a guzzling entrance that was large enough to consume my mother and me. Eyeing the dark alleyway that bridged the gap between the creature's world and Earth, I reached for my mother's hand. "How do you know?" Mom asked in a frightened whisper. "How do you know that we won't suffer again?" "I don't!" I yelled. My mother looked into the eyes of the morose man, launched toward us, limbs squeezing through narrow doorways. She nodded, grasped my hand, and ran with me. We darted through the darkened alleyway and catapulted our bodies through the living room door. After scrambling to my feet, I closed the living room door on the ever-nearing entity. Clomping footsteps echoed around the alleyway on the other side of the door, but I raced to complete the final step of the ritual, to sever the bridge between worlds. A new door must be opened. I lunged toward the kitchen door, and as the main door to the living room burst from its hinges, I swung the second door open. My mother and I screamed as the morose man withered into darkness a mere meter away from us. Thankfully, our familiar downstairs hallway stood in place of that terrifying alleyway. I visited Paige. I don't know the girl, of course, but I felt obligated to thank her. Obligated, perhaps, to save her, too. She and my mother both struggle to trust the world. In time, I hope that changes. I hope you enjoyed We Keep Our Kindness by Dominic Eagle, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dominic-Eagle. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/DominicEagle. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And speaking of legends, the Morose Man has appeared in other tales. Be sure to see his growing collection of stories from Dominic at your leisure and at your own risk. Finally, we reach the end of the evening together with one final tale from Nikki Exposito of a storefront that nobody can ever seem to keep occupied. It almost seems like there's a curse at work, or that can't be the case, right? Without further ado, I present to you the legend of Wokang's Dry Goods on 30th Avenue. My earliest memory of the old Wokang's Dry Goods building on 30th Avenue in Astoria is a blurry mess of primary colors and flashing lights, metallic clangs, and the sticky sweet smell of stale popcorn and spilled soda. It was Wham! Arcade then, in 1992, when I was six. My brother liked the arcade a lot more than I did. I was a nervous kid, and I much preferred playing Super Mario Brothers on my Game Boy alone in my room to the loud rows of flashy machines with joysticks I could never grasp right. I remember the little boy with the curly red hair who asked me to play. I'd seen him at Wham! Before. He was a strange, quiet kid with eyes that never seemed to focus right. My brother told me the boy was the son of the arcade's owner, a surly, pudgy, perennially sweaty man who sat behind the prize counter, glaring. I agreed to play Mortal Kombat with the boy. He led me to the console and dropped in a quarter, and we picked our characters. My heart began to race. My sweaty palms and hands slipped and slid on the buttons, and I think I lasted 30 seconds before the game growled, "Fatality." "Ha! You suck," howled my brother from the Alpha Magician machine. Hung my head in shame. The little boy with the curly red hair smiled at me, though. He extended a hand. "Good game," he said. Then he froze in place like a grinning statue. I realized he expected me to reciprocate. "Good game," I responded. My next memory of the old Wokang's Dry Goods building happened 5 years later. Not longer after the red-headed boy handed me my ass at Mortal Kombat, Wham! Arcade went under. A boutique selling willowy, flowery women's clothes opened in the space. Less than a year later, the building had been abandoned. Eventually, a used music shop took over the storefront. Chip and Scratch's CDs and records. There were dusty old albums displayed in the windows, and an infrequent flow of scruffy, greasy-haired men in peacoats in and out of the doors. My karate dojo was down the street. Greg Costas, a 13-year-old brown belt, loved terrifying us younger kids with scary stories he'd lived from short and shivery and try and pass off as true. "This one's real, though," he insisted that day. "Cross my heart and hope to die. It happened to my Sunday school buddy's cousin friend from soccer. You know the record store? The one across the street? It's haunted." Miguel Carrero snorted. "You still believe in ghosts, Costas? That's sad." "That's sensei to you, Carrero. The building was built, like, in 1900 by a guy named Wolfgang Stoud. He had a store and sold random crap. But later on, during Prohibition, his real business was a speakeasy. That means he sold illegal alcohol." "We know what a speakeasy is, Costas," said another boy. "Again, it's sensei. And yeah, he sold illegal alcohol in the basement. There was a secret door to get down there. You couldn't get in without the password, and everybody used to say that old Wolfgang Stoud didn't just keep liquor in the basement. It's where he buried the bodies of gangsters who pissed him off." Greg paused for effect. I breathed deeply, in and out, trying to slow my racing heart. I don't like horror stories. My buddy's cousin's soccer friend was a dude named Kevin. Before the record store opened, when the building was empty, he and a group of guys broke in because one of their brothers dared them to. The other guys said it wasn't even scary. But Kevin got weird after. Once, he asked my brother's cousin if he knew the man with suspenders and a hat following them. But there was no man there. I wiped my sweaty hands on my karate pants. I wanted to escape to the bathroom, but I didn't want the guys to think I was a pussy. "He'd talk to people no one could see," Greg continued. "Ghosts. Or he'd run out of class randomly, screaming about a man with a gun. He told my buddy's cousin he woke up in the middle of the night and there was someone on his chest trying to strangle him. They wanted him to go back, he said. Back to the abandoned building, to the basement. Finally, he did what the ghost said, and..." Greg paused again. I twitched. I wanted to cry. "And then, he died," Greg announced dramatically. "Kevin died. He dropped dead in the middle of a soccer game. My buddy's cousin ran to him. Kevin's last words before his eyes closed forever were, 'Please don't let the man with the hat take me.'" I slept with the lights on for a month. My third memory of the old Wolfgang's dry goods building took place rather recently. The storefront had been abandoned again for a while since the owner-operator of Gino's Gyros was sent on a trip upriver, courtesy of the feds for insurance fraud. I found the front door unlocked, as the property manager assured me it would be. My mission: scout a location for Tomato Tart, the second Neapolitan-style pizza joint by Chef Kylie Noel. Kylie was a friend from culinary school. She'd already ran one phenomenally successful restaurant in Dumbo and wanted to plant her flag in Queens with me as her sous chef. The old Wolfgang dry goods building was, well, actually, quite nice. It had an Art Deco feel, checkered tile floor, ornate geometric designs cut into the wood of the bar, combined with that of an Irish pub. We'd need to do some remodeling, put in a pizza oven, but the kitchen was spacious and already equipped with a large walk-in fridge and freezer. Between the fridge and freezer, there was a door, a narrow wooden door, cut into the white plaster walls of the kitchen, with a green-tinged metallic knob and fancy carved patterns to match the Art Deco bar outside. There was a brass-colored placard at eye level with a calligraphic word carved into it. Password. Password. With a whoosh of consciousness, I was 11 years old and in my karate dojo, listening to Greg Costas spinning his tale of his friend of a friend
kicking the bucket on the soccer field, pursued by invisible 20s gangsters. I breathed in the faintest whiff of stale popcorn and sticky spilled soda. I suddenly wanted to be as far away from the abandoned restaurant as I could get. Then I remembered, as I was a nearly 40-year-old man, not an anxious kid. I took some pictures for Kylie, then shut off the lights and locked the door behind me. Fitting, I thought. I'm back at the scene of my humiliating Mortal Kombat loss, the site of my biting childhood failure. The last few years of my life, I marinated in failure. I started west on 30th Avenue toward the subway overpass. Well, maybe it all was a sign my days of failure were over. As soon as we nailed down a location, I'd be Kylie Noel's sous chef. The N train rumbled into the station overhead. "You're going to tank this restaurant like you tanked yours, John?" A sharp voice snapped right behind me. I whirled around. There was no one there. As it turned out, Greg Costas was full of crap. After sending the pictures to Kylie, I curled up at a Yemeni coffee shop with my laptop and an iced Denny chai. My return to the old Wolfgang's Dry Goods building had inspired me to fact-check Greg's dumb karate class story. A seventh grader dropping dead during a soccer game would have been rare enough occurrence to make the news. I skimmed old archives, Googled keywords, and posted the story on the local Astoria subreddit. Old newspapers and obituaries gave me nothing. No hallucinating little soccer player named Kevin tragically struck down on the field. On Reddit, though, a user, Bildebay, posted a letter to the editor published in her hometown Connecticut paper from 1993. She'd kept it because she thought it was funny. "Always know where your kids are. My sister-in-law, a psychiatric nurse in New York City, recently related to me the tragic tale of a 16-year-old girl, Rebecca. Young Rebecca, like many young people, fell in love with the wrong crowd at school. Her new friends' lives were consumed with drugs, Dungeons and Dragons, and heavy metal music, and soon so was Rebecca's. On Halloween, this clique of young people broke into an abandoned store. They did drugs, then performed a ritual with an Ouija board. Harmless fun, Rebecca's friends insisted. But only days later, Rebecca became convinced something was constantly behind her. She asked her mother if she saw the man with a thousand of eyes. She described a creature with goat horns and hooves who stared back at her from inside the mirror. Then, one night, Rebecca ate dinner with her mother. She stood abruptly and, face twisted in fear, whispered, "The goat man wants me to come with him." Then she collapsed. The paramedics couldn't revive her. She died of a sudden heart attack. So, not only was Greg Costas a liar, he couldn't even come up with his own material. Another Redditor chimed in. User WeaponizedBlonde7171 recalled another version of the same story presented to her as something that really happened to a brother's co-worker in a faraway city by her high school sex ed teacher. She said this guy broke into a comic book store to have unprotected sex with his girlfriend. Weaponized Blonde 7171 wrote, and he got syphilis. The syphilis made him go crazy, like he hallucinated all the time. He'd ask if anyone else saw the big blue tiger. He thought a monkey was following him around. Finally, he broke into the same comic book store again because deep in his psychosis, he thought it would cure him. And he actually got better. Then he relapsed and died. Y'all, this story made me a virgin until college. And now I learn it's all BS. You see, the horror story that scared 11-year-old me senseless was an urban legend. Typically, multiple versions of an urban legend exist. The basic structure is the same, with enough wiggle room for the teller to improvise the details based on their own or their culture's experiences and fears. Greg's mistake?
He made his story too local. The power of urban legends is that they always happen in an unspecified faraway place. Greg's utilization of the old Wolfgang's dry goods building made his tall tale all too easy to fact-check. Hey, John, the restaurant will burn and you'll drag her down with you. The same sharp, harsh voice in my ear. I sprung to my feet and did a 360. I was alone, save for the bored-looking girl behind the counter, completely involved with her phone. Something moved in the corner of my eye, a black cockroach, ducking back into a hole in the wooden baseboards. I took that as a sign it was time to pack my things and go home. As I walked out the door, I could have sworn I caught the scent of popcorn and sugary cornstarch. I trembled. My meeting with Leona Burrell didn't put me in a better mood. 2 weeks had passed since I set foot in the old Wolfgang's dry goods building. Kylie said she liked the pictures. She wasn't sold, though. The place was too close to the noisy train tracks. If it were any other location, I'd have been frustrated to the point of blind fury. The rent was considerably cheaper than what we had any right to expect anywhere in the city. That particular location, though? I'd be lying if I said it didn't give me the heebs. I heard the scratchy, disembodied voice 3 more times. The first time I was at work at TGI Fridays, alone in the break room, guzzling a Red Bull before returning to the line. "You're a fat old loser," the voice hissed in my ear. "Nearly 40 years old, John, and this is all you have to show for yourself?" On the floor, under the lockers, 2 cockroaches scurried around each other and into a discarded ramen cup. I tossed my drink and ran. The second time I was at the park with my kids. Theo bonded with a beagle in the dog run while Cassidy flew higher and higher on the swings. "It's your fault you lost the house. When they learn that, they'll never forgive you." Panic seized up in my chest. Was I a schizophrenic? Experiencing a side effect of alcohol withdrawal related to my 38-day-old sobriety? I made a mental note to call my GP on Monday. I gathered the kids and told them it was time to leave, bribing them with the promise of a gelato. The third time was later that day. I'd just gotten off the R train. Having completed the last leg of the epic trip to return my kids to their mother in White Plains. As I walked back to the Jackson Heights one-bedroom I sublet, I passed by a lively dive bar. Unpretentious, the sort of place where weekend warriors played lousy pool and sang tone-deaf de karaoke. "Should go in," the voice taunted. "Everyone knows this AA thing isn't going to last." I whirled around, fists clenched. My invisible friend could scare me in the break room all it wanted, but if it thought it could screw with my sobriety, it had another thing coming. But, as I'd come to expect, I was alone on the street. Alone, except for a dark horde of cockroaches in the gutter, crawling around a discarded kebab sandwich. "Have you noticed more roaches out lately?" I asked Leona. "It's January. They're supposed to stay in their hidey holes until June." Leona shrugged. "Not really." Leona Burrell agreed to meet me at the Starbucks in Astoria. We'd been friends for years, ever since our days at Le Petit Rose in the village. Her, the night supervisor, me, the twitchy new line cook. When Kylie finally settled on the location for Tomato Tart, I intended to hire Leona on as the general manager. "The place you told me about in Astoria," Leona said. "I know it. I don't want to work there again." "The old Wolfgang dry goods building? Again?" I had no idea she'd worked there before. She nodded. "Yeah, 2004. Toddy's Bean Town?" It was a coffee shop with a kind of central perk from Friends vibe. I worked as a barista there for a few years in my 20s. It was fine, but one of my co-workers got a stalker. Something cold settled on my skin at the word stalker. "Like an ex-boyfriend?" I asked Leona. "My boyfriend is stretching it," Leona said. "He was a customer, this harmless-looking dude.
They went on one date. She didn't feel a spark. He? Well, he started popping up everywhere. Her college campus, her apartment, even her mom's house. Did the police ever get the guy? I asked, wiping my sweaty palms on my jeans. She rolled her eyes. And the stalking laws were trash in the early 2000s. And she died. My heartbeat accelerated like a roller coaster. He killed her? Not exactly, Leona said sadly. She had a brain aneurysm, a genetic thing. But I'm pretty sure the stress of the situation didn't make it better. Oh, I'm sorry, I told Leona. I don't know what else to say. You ever hear the urban legend where it seemed inappropriate? We sat in silence for a moment, sipping out coffees. There was an arcade in that building once, too, Leona said finally. I frowned. You knew the arcade? Yeah, the kids I babysat were obsessed. I'd always end up getting roped into losing a game to this little boy, David, the owner's son. The kid with the curly red hair? I asked, cringing involuntarily at the memory. Yep, he was a real-life arcade wizard, she said. I never saw him lose a game. I'm glad he had something, though, poor little guy. What do you mean? She eyed me like I was the most oblivious person in the world. John, you seriously didn't notice? I was 10 and I picked up on it. Picked up on what? An uncomfortable sourness curdled in my veins. He was skinny, like malnourished skinny, and there were always bruises all over him. I hadn't looked at my Reddit post in weeks. After my coffee with Leona, though, I had an irresistible impulse to check in and see if any other Redditors had chimed in with added perspective. Because I didn't know. I couldn't say the words, not even to myself. I'm a nearly 40-year-old adult and father. I'm not a nervous kid. Reddit, though? Reddit delivered. Oh, did it ever deliver. First, user BoilinBass3500 had done some research. He gave us all the full history of the old Wolfgang Dry Goods building. Construction was begun in 1912 and finished in 1913, he wrote. Wolfgang Stode, the original owner, ran a dry goods store until his death in 1928. His son took over the business, but it went under during the Great Depression, and the building remained an empty, poorly maintained bank property until it was purchased by Queens Properties United in 1940 and leased to a Walgreens drugstore. The Walgreens closed in 1974. The building housed a disco club for a short time, then a men's clothing store. From 1983 to 1993, Wham! Arcade occupied the storefront. After the arcade was unexpectedly abandoned, a series of businesses opened and closed in the spot. Laura's Boutique, 1995-96, Chip and Scratch Records, 1997 to 1999, The Bar on the Tracks, 1999 to 2002, Toddy's Beantown, 2002 to 2004, Lowe and Ludwig Coffee, 2004-2005. Hamidi Kebabs, 2005 to 2010. Amado Pizzeria, 2010-2011. The Grey Cat Tea Room, 2011-2012. Big Time Natural Foods, 2012-2013. Larson's Market, 2013 to 2015. Dog Place, 2015 to 2016. Black Rain Bakery, 2016 to 2017. Bubbles Tavern, 2017 to 2018. The AC Lover, 2018 to 2019. The Nut House, 2019 to 2020. Kawaii Boba, 2020-2021. Just Grilled, 2021-2022. And Gino's Gyros, 2022 to 2023. I counted 23 businesses in total. Since 2010,
Only one lasted longer than a year. That was a lot. Even in the fickle, high-risk, high-reward New York entrepreneurial scene, that was a lot. Then there were the urban legends, different now from the first few I'd read. These urban legends didn't take place in an unspecified locale, far away. Each and every one centered on the old Wolfgang's dry goods building and the 23 businesses that had operated and failed there. User, I caught the flying sausage. Oh, crap, not that place. My dumbass friend dated a girl whose brother worked at the greasy grilled cheese shop. The brother told her the building had built on top of an ancient Native American graveyard. He swore ghostly Native American warriors were chasing him around the city. User Turbo Gerbil 1925. This hippie chick my ex-boyfriend used to smoke weed with told him it was built on a fairy circle, not a graveyard. Apparently her boss pissed off the other side. I think she worked there when it was a natural food store. Anyway, the boss had some sort of mental breakdown. I think he ended up dying. User Runner in the Night 42. LOL. What? You know a serial killer used to be a cook at the pizza joint, right? He'd lure chicks to the basement and seal their bodies up in the walls. User Lolo Panda. I heard the woman who ran the Grey Cat Tea Room was a witch. When her business failed during the recession, she put a curse on the store. That's why no business ever succeeds there for longer than 2 years. User Attic Cat 1290. This is a throwaway. Can you DM me? I think we should talk in person. I didn't know what to make of all these accounts, or how they related to me, or the voice, or the cockroaches I kept spotting, or Liana's victimized coffee shop co-worker, or little red-haired David, the arcade owner's son. So I ignored Attic Cat 1290's request. I turned off my computer. I went to CVS and invested in a can of Raid. Long past midnight, I jerked awake. I felt something small and itchy brush against my leg. Or maybe my eyes snapped open because my spidey senses alerted me I wasn't alone. Through my bedroom window, the city lights cast a pale, silvery column across the floor. A small, fast-moving blotch jutted into the light and disappeared into the darkness. I sat up in bed and reached for my light. Wispy, disorganized legs skittered across my hand. I jerked back as I pulled the chain. My room was coated in cockroaches. Hundreds of cockroaches. Cockroaches clustering in the windows, up the walls, stacked in corners. Thousands of tiny legs sprinting across the floor. Quivering feelers, flitting wings, cockroaches piling on top of each other, and mating and fighting and scaling the walls and skittering across the ceiling. I closed my eyes and screamed. I screamed until I couldn't breathe. I opened my eyes, panting and gasping for air. The cockroaches were gone. Then the voices started. There were many of them now, male and female, guttural and nasal, vicious whispers and mocking taunts. How'd you get so fat, John? You're a slightly better father than you are a businessman, but that bar is practically on the floor. Your face looks like a French bulldog crossed with a rat. You're such a loser. Do you fully comprehend how embarrassed your parents are to have spawned you? Thank God your brother's successful, or they'd probably kill themselves in shame. Your ex-wife is better off without you. Your kids are better off without you. I couldn't take it anymore. I stood up, threw on jeans and a sweatshirt, grabbed my laptop, and ran out of my apartment. If you want us to go away, a sing-song female voice cajoled, you know where to find us. I took refuge in a 24-hour diner. Kylie had sent me a message. Went to see the potential location in Long Island City, she typed. The plumbing doesn't work. Surprise! You'll never guess how much money this low-life property manager had the absolute gall to quote me. Let's talk more about the place in Astoria tomorrow. I'll deal with the noisy train so long as the toilet's flush. She was warming up to the old Wolfgang Dry Goods building, the place where 23 businesses failed. The cursed location, claimed by fairies and ghostly Native American warriors, where a serial killer buried dead girls in the basement walls. I logged onto Reddit and messaged AtticCat1290. I asked when and where she wanted to meet. AtticCat1290, Claudia, met me at a coffee shop on Steinway. Claudia was a bony blonde in her mid-30s, a respiratory therapist at Bellevue Hospital. She had a prominent nose and wide-set eyes, and her skin wrinkled in a way that gave the impression of rapid recent weight loss. She picked at her nails as we spoke, her eyes darting to and fro. "You think the old Wolfgang's Dry Goods building is haunted?" I said. She pursed her lips. "I don't know. Haunted might be the wrong word. I'd say it chose me. The place chooses people." I nodded. "I used to walk by the building on my way to the train," she explained. "Back when the grilled cheese shop was there, I'd stop for coffee and a breakfast sandwich a couple times a week. I got friendly with this young guy who worked there, a kid named Sam. We'd talk about TV shows and baseball. Well, one day, Sam disappeared. His co-worker told me he'd had a mental breakdown. I felt sad, but there wasn't much I could do. It's not like we were besties. Something tugged unpleasantly on my id. My dumbass friend dated a girl whose brother worked at the grilled cheese shop. The Reddit thread. The guy who had been chased by ghost warriors. I kept on going to the grilled cheese place, and then when it shut down, the gyro place. Claudia continued. I can't explain what happened. Just, I've always been nervous about doctors and hospitals and medical stuff. I had allergies when I was a kid. I was poked so many times I developed a lifelong fear of needles. But that all happened years ago, and I thought I'd gotten over it. She took a deep breath. Suddenly, one day, I started seeing these people in white scrubs with caps and masks, standing there on a street corner or a subway platform, staring at me, sometimes holding a cartoonishly huge syringe with a giant needle. No one else could see them but me. At first, they kept their distance. Then one appeared in an elevator. Then I woke up to a giant man in scrubs standing over my bed. I trembled. Goosebumps rose in my arms. "I see cockroaches," I told her. She raised her eyebrows. "Are you scared of bugs?" "Not exactly." I took a deep breath. "I used to co-own a restaurant, Diego's Hideout in Williamsburg. Mexican fusion." Claudia looked confused. I decided not to feel offended she'd never heard of my restaurant. She'd been honest with me. I could be honest with her. "We were successful, ridiculously successful. A couple of people complained they'd seen roaches in the dining room, but I didn't think it was an immediate problem. It was New York in the summer. There's roaches everywhere. Then, one morning, I walked into the kitchen, and the entire place was crawling with cockroaches. They were all over the floor and walls and the dishes in the sink. My body twitched. Words couldn't do justice to the physical icky sensation of watching those legs and feelers and crusty wings writhe and clutter. We had to shut down for 2 weeks, I continued. Word got out why, and we never recovered. Turns out no one wants to eat at the cockroach restaurant. We went bankrupt 4 months later. Oh, and to make things even better, I'd just taken out a mortgage I could no longer afford, and my wife and I lost the house. She left me. I started drinking while the sun was still up. And now I'm seeing roaches everywhere and hearing psycho disembodied voices demand I come and find them. Claudia stared at me, considering. "They wanted me to go back," she said, finally, firmly. "The creepy figures in scrubs wanted me to return to the building, the gyro place, and then go down to the basement. The place had been closed and abandoned by then. I picked the lock late one night. Her eyes flickered in resemblance. I suddenly thought of the wooden door in the kitchen, the Art Deco piece, politely inquiring after a password. There was an arcade in the basement, Claudia said. It took me a second to process her words. An arcade? The whole building used to be an arcade. Yeah, well, apparently, they took all the games down to the basement. All these old 80s-styled machines. I could only get one to work, a fighter game, like Mortal Kombat. The gist was you played an adventurer battling it out with Native American spirit guardians to find a buried treasure in an old graveyard. It was actually really racist. And I lost in about 2 seconds. As soon as I lost, though, it was over. Like you stopped hallucinating? I cut in, suddenly caught up in a wave of hope. She sighed. Yeah. I stopped seeing the scrubbed figures with masks. But it might be more complicated. Because that kid I talked about, Sam, the sandwich shop guy, who had a mental breakdown, I learned later that he died. I couldn't pick the lock on the old Wolfgang's Dry Goods building while it was still light out. No way that wouldn't get me a free night in a jail cell. So I waited until about 4 in the morning, chugging Red Bull at the deli until the last of the bar patrons stumbled into the subway, leaving me alone on the street. In the nameless spirits of the Wolfgang's Dry Goods building that wanted me to play video games in the basement arcade, then video games I would play. The lock snapped open in seconds. I found my way through the abandoned restaurant with a flashlight on my phone. Steeped in darkness, the once welcoming atmosphere had become gloomy and imposing. The wood-paneled walls trapped the blackness. The geometric Art Deco carvings threw jarring shadows. I wandered into the kitchen, up to the little wooden door between the fridge and freezer. I tried the greenish metallic knob. It didn't so much as jiggle. The door was locked. Locked, it appeared, from the inside. I stared at the placard. Password. The basement, where Wolfgang stowed, kept his bootlegged alcohol. Where apparently the arcade's owner had stashed his collection of consoles. I recall the arcade closed suddenly. No warning, just a chain on the door one morning. Poor little boy, Leona said. Little David, the kid with the curly red hair. Password. Good game, I said to the door. There was a snap, then a creak, and the door popped open. I pulled it wide and found myself staring down a set of wooden stairs. I smelled stale popcorn and sticky sweet spilled soda. As I climbed carefully down the stairs, I heard metallic trills and jaunty, computerized music. Bright lights flashed, multicolored, against the walls, and then I was there. It was just as Claudia said it would be. Just as Wham! Arcade had once been. Rows of giant computer consoles with dancing graphics and greasy joysticks. The first game I came to was called Nephilim. It looked like a fighter game. The sides decorated with disturbing images of eye-covered men and goat-headed women. Next to Phillim sat Speakeasy, a shooter game. Prohibition-themed, you had to fire at hat and suspenders wearing thugs come to steal your stash. Across the room, a pastel-colored Pac-Man-esque game, Escape from the Zoo. Instead of Pac-Man ghosts, you got chased by blue tigers and purple monkeys. I didn't question how the flashing lights and dancing graphics were even possible, as the electricity in the building had been shut off for months. I walked down the rows, passing Fairy Quest, the Grey Witch's Cat, an extremely kid-inappropriate and generally problematic game called Rear Window, in which you had to stalk a girl through a series of obstacles. Then, Homicide 911, where you were tasked with picking up enough clues to jail a serial killer before he murdered again. Besides that, I spotted Graves of Our Ancestors, decorated with moderately offensive Native American imagery. I guess this was the game Claudia had played. I pressed buttons and looked for coin slots, but the only game that worked properly, the only one I was allowed to play, was the game furthest from the door on the right. Hospital Nightmares, it was called. According to the graphics, it worked a bit like Frogger. I needed to avoid mad scientists trying to inject me with serum. As soon as I grasped the joystick, my hands began to sweat. I felt my heart pounding in my ears as the bouncing music swelled. I shook as I tried to remember which button did what. People are staring. I'm going to fail, just like I always fail. A melancholy trill from the game. Fatality, a computerized voice croaked. I stepped back, watched my pathetic avatar collapse to the ground, while a ghoulish doctor laughed maniacally. There was peace in failure. Now I can go back to my room and play Super Mario Brothers to my heart's content. I don't remember leaving the basement arcade or taking zigzagging trains home or collapsing into bed. The next day, I awoke past noon from the best sleep of my life. I didn't see any more cockroaches or hear the voices. I worked a shift and made plans with Kylie, then went to an AA meeting. I deleted my post off Reddit. I texted Claudia a couple of times. I told her she was right. An operating arcade had been squatting in the old Wolfgang's Dry Goods building basement. For days, she ignored me. Then, today, someone texted me back. Claudia's sister. She told me Claudia was dead. Sudden cardiac death, a heart attack in her sleep, secondary to some structural problem she hadn't known she'd had. I offered the sister my condolences. I said I'd only known her for a short time, but Claudia was there for me when I needed honesty and direction, and for that I'd eternally be thankful. I tried really hard not to think about the fact that she'd died the exact same night I'd gone down to the arcade in the basement, or that her time of death was uncomfortably close to the time I must have lost miserably at the Hospital Nightmares game. All right, so, not sure what to say here. This is Jose, John's brother. I found this account on my brother's computer. If you're reading this, I'm really sorry to break this to you, but John passed away 3 weeks ago. We're still waiting on autopsy results, but I think it was an aortic aneurysm rupture. I'm tempted to say my brother must have been losing it, that he was suffering from either an undiagnosed mental condition or a brain tumor. But the comments on his deleted Reddit post are still up. And I don't know, this is all too weird for me. Basically, I see the situation as John saw it, was thus. The old Wolfgang's Dry Goods building is haunted by a supernatural entity. This entity chooses people. It latches onto them, stalks them, casts horrific hallucinations, plays off their fears and insecurities. It lures them in, then leads them along a breadcrumb trail to the arcade in the basement. Here's where it gets tricky. The quarry, my brother John, or Claudia before him, plays one game. What they're playing for is the life of the previous quarry, against the game based on the previous quarry's specific narrative and hallucinations. Claudia lost her game, so Sam, the sandwich guy, died. John lost his game, the game with the killer hospital and insane doctors, and Claudia died. Following this logic, I'm left to assume the building claimed another quarry after John. The new quarry found their way to the basement. They played a game against, I don't know, a giant cockroach or something. They lost the game. Then John died. This is stuff fairy tales. An entity that collects people, takes possession of their fears and their stories, and keeps them locked in a basement in the form of 90s-styled arcade games. I'd say it's all a stupid urban legend. Except. The old Wolfgang's Dry Goods building is gone. It caught on fire. accidentally or intentionally, no one's sure, and no one particularly cares. And by the time the firefighters got there, the building was beyond saving. There were no old arcade games found in the basement. The basement was empty. However, the crew, cleaning up the debris, made a gruesome discovery sealed in the basement walls. A small corpse, the remains of a 5 to 7-year-old child, shoved into the insulation and plastered over, hidden away for years and forgotten. The child's cause of death was assumed to be a giant crack in his skull. A DNA test revealed the dead kid to be David Miles. It's suspected he died at the hands of his father, Wayne Miles, who owned the Wham Arcade in the 80s and 90s. I hope you enjoyed The Legend of Wolfgang's Dry Goods on 30th Avenue by Nikki Exposito, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Nikki-Exposito. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Nikki-Exposito. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I would like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky. Get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?